We're speaking to Colonel David Lowndes, the commander of the 26th Marine Regiment during its successful defense of the Quezon Combat Base. Colonel Lowndes was awarded the Navy Cross for his leadership and conduct during the siege, and the 26th Marines have been given a Presidential Unit Citation. The Colonel is married, and his wife Jean, along with their 7 children, now live in Plantation, Florida. Colonel Lowndes is a 26-year veteran of the Marine Corps, having served in World War II, the Korean War, the crisis in Santo Domingo, where he won the Bronze Star, and then subsequently in Vietnam. This is May 23, 1968. I'm Marine Captain Bill Stuckey. Colonel, what was the overall personal opinion of yours of your duty at Quezon?
About all I can say about the duty at Quezon is that I think that every Marine lives for the day when he can be a leader or have a unit of his own. And for me to be able to command the 26th Marines was an honor and something that would have to be a highlight in any man's career. So the duty there, as far as I'm concerned, I was a regimental commander and it was wonderful.
What, in your opinion, was the critical period at Quezon?
This question has been asked of me many times as to the critical period at Quezon, and I think probably that there were a number of critical periods. Any time you receive a probe of battalion size, you kind of wonder what's following behind it, particularly when you know that there's a couple of divisions out there. So each time, and of course I should add that each time these probes come, the increase in artillery, mortars, and rockets came. So that I'd say that the critical times were a series of them when they made the battalion size attacks on the hills or on the combat base. So if you pick one critical period, I don't think I could isolate just one.
You mentioned battalion and regimental size enemy forces. What was the intelligence picture in terms of enemy strength, also their weapons, and the disposition thereof?
And of course, this is hard to evaluate by a regimental commander because the intelligence sources available to him are those which are basically organic to the regiment. He has to be helped out by higher headquarters, and in terms of enemy strength, from the information we gleaned from our own sources and from those sources higher than us, there probably were a couple divisions around us, and they were armed with artillery, mortars, rockets, and as you saw, probably read, they also had some small tanks, which they used in particular down towards Long Bay, the Special Forces camp.
Colonel, would you outline the exact strategic importance of Quezon?
Well, again, you're asking a regimental commander who is really just a small element of an overall picture in Vietnam, what the strategic importance is. Regimental commanders, to be honest with you, don't worry much about strategic importance. They're worried about tactical importance. And if you say strategically, then I think you've probably got to talk to people like General Westmoreland and people like that. I just can't answer the question because I don't know all of the factors that go into the strategic importance of Quezon.
Well, then what was the tactical importance from your...
Well, of course, and then again, I guess I left myself open there, but then again, my concern, as you probably know, my mission in Quezon was to defend Quezon Combat Base and the ancillary facilities around it and to prevent enemy infiltration through the area. Now, these were my mission, which were given to me by higher headquarters, and these are the things that I fulfilled. Why I did these things were decided by other people, and I just don't have any comment on that.
I see, sir. If your Marines, the 26th Marines reinforced at Quezon, had been overrun, what advantage, if any, would the North Vietnamese regulars have realized?
I refuse to really comment on that for this reason, that I had said from the very beginning, and I say now again for I don't know how many times, that it never entered my mind that the Marines could be put out of Quezon. To me, was unbelievable, and therefore, I never even stopped to think about what would happen if we got out of there. All I knew was that I had Marines, and I had South Vietnamese, and I had some Army troops, and I had the best there was, and there wasn't anybody going to take me out of there. Well, at least no 20,000 of them, which is what they said they had around. There were no 20,000 going to take us out of there. When you attack a dug-in outfit, my personal views are that you have to have at least 8 to 10 to 1. He didn't have no 8 to 10 to 1, and there weren't nobody going to move us.
Then, Colonel, do you feel that the training, the esprit de corps, the leadership, and the morale of the 26 Marines reinforced was of such a caliber and of such a nature and of such a high degree that even these odds could not have transplanted you from Khe Sanh?
Yes, you said it, and I agree 100%. That it was there. The average Marine today is as good or better than he ever was. And these kids got spirit, and they've got the morale, and they've got everything that they want. Our leaders are younger, a little bit younger than they used to be. Now, I'm not talking about colonels and the old fossils like myself. I'm talking about the corporal down at the squad and the squad leader and a platoon sergeant. He's young, but he's willing, he's eager, and he's learning every day. And I just couldn't say enough for him.
Colonel, reports from Khe Sanh earlier indicated that the base was entirely surrounded and also at the mercy of the North Vietnamese and or the enemy artillery. Was this really true?
Well, you get the feeling, and of course I've been out of Vietnam only a short length of time, but you get the feeling that we were poor, beat-down boys just laying there waiting for the inevitable to happen. And this just is a completely erroneous picture. To anybody who spent any time at Khe Sanh knows that the morale was high and that we were always doing things, we were always getting ready, and the base, I guess, I don't think I could deny that it might have been surrounded. At least we could always manage to get a fight on any side. Now, as for we are at the mercy of them, depends what you call mercy of them. Certainly, the pounding that they took back was for everyone they put out, we put out more than that, and they were taking a pounding. I don't know that we were at their mercy. I think mercy connotates that we could do nothing about it, and this is not true. We had ways to fight back, and we used every one we had.
Well, then, the incoming from the enemy artillery was, to term it as a proportion, was large, though.
Well, I thought it, I sure tell you when we hit the 1,300 rounds in one day, I sure as heck thought it was a lot. But when I read some of the accounts that from other people of other major actions, maybe it wasn't as large as I thought it was. But let me tell you, when you get 1,300 rounds in a day, you know you've had some artillery.
Well, since we've established that it was a large amount of incoming enemy fire, what precautions did you take as the regimental commander to minimize casualties and also to bolster the morale?
Well, I guess honestly, let me answer the last part first. I don't know what I did to bolster morale other than the normal leadership things that any leader tries to do. But I do know that whatever it was a darn good solution because the kids really responded. They had morale. It never went down. And I'm not sure that in part it has to go back to your small unit leader. The colonel only sees so many people in a day. The squad leader, platoon sergeant sees the same faces every day. And if you're going to talk about morale, you got to talk about the corporal and the sergeant who are down with the troops in the trenches, and he's the guy that really builds morale. So that's the first part. What was the first part of the question you asked me?
What precautions did you take as the commanding officer?
Well, naturally, there are so many things tied into precautions. For example, digging. and overheading and bunkers and precautions, for example, making sure you got enough doctors and blood for the casualties. There are so many, and they're all intertwined and wrapped up in each other that it's pretty hard I could sit here probably an hour and tell you things that I did over 70-some-odd days that I felt were taking those precautions which are required, but I've outlined a few of the different types, making sure that you've got ways to move casualties, and there's just so many things. It all wraps up into one bundle of wax, and it's pretty hard to break any of them out.
Let's move now, Colonel, to another method of probing and or attacking. And let me ask you, how extensive was the ground action at Quezon?
Well, contrary to evidently some of the thinking, there was stuff going on every day. There have been or had been reports that we were cooped up and unable to get outside the perimeter and just sitting there. And this is not exactly true, because there were patrols going out every day. I think it'd be less than honest to say that some of these patrols were venturing out too far, because in some areas, as you've seen in pictures, the enemy trenches came up pretty close to the perimeter of the base. However, there were areas of around that we went out 1,000 meters or in excess of that every single day. I use as a typical example the fact that the drop zone was outside of the perimeter of the base, and we managed to keep that open and keep things going. Now, there were at least what I considered to be five major size attacks, although only one of them really took place on the perimeter of the base. When you talk about the defense of the combat, Quezon Combat Base, you have to remember that the kids on the hills on 881, 861, 861A, 557, 950 probably don't mean much on a radio type thing, but they were all an important part of the interview, all part of the action at Quezon. Now, these attacks on the hills were, he was trying to take advantage of the outposts to get them out of the way so he could get at the main base. And the kids, I guess I shouldn't call them kids, the Marines on these hills always acquitted themselves very admirably. They took all of the action on the wire. They took the heavy size attacks and turned them back. In one case, they lost half a hill. They counterattacked and retook the other half of the hill. If you're talking about a division size attack all at one time, we didn't get it. But this is a credit to the men that were there that size attack did not take place.
Colonel, in view of what you just said, obviously your men were well qualified. So when you took command, what measures did you take to ensure the defensibility of Quezon and its position in outlying hills?
That's such a broad question that I hope I did so many things that we were successful, which I guess is proven in the results. There were so many things that you have to do. Yeah, there was trenches to be dug, there was wire to be put in, there was mines to be put in, and there were units that required training from the time that I got there before the heavy fighting started, and even after the heavy fighting started, replacements came in. It's almost an impossibility in the short time we have to elaborate all of the things that we did. It just was a complete cycle of getting people qualified and ready, and not qualified and ready. I can't say that, because the men we got were qualified and ready. It really wasn't qualification and readiness of individuals. It was a qualification and readiness of units. In other words, integrating individuals into units.
And or honing it to a fine edge.
And also honing it. Of course, the unit, when we talk about integrating, we're not talking whole globs of men, we're talking individual replacements. The basic units in Vietnam, of course, are all well-qualified and well-trained and highly capable. But so it's the integration of the replacements for those boys who are rotating and or are casualties.
Colonel, since Marines have always been traditionally offensive in nature, how did your command accept this somewhat static situation or defensive situation?
I think that this is one of the finest examples that I can think of why Marines are Marines and always have had the capability of doing what they're told. The men at Quezon, as you say, are basically trained as offensive type people. Yet they were able, and I think we overlook one aspect, so we have to carry it a step further, but I think one of the things that I'm proudest of, that I could have been commander of a unit that could go from an offensive situation, which we were in prior to the big build-up by the North Vietnamese, to a defensive posture for 70-odd days where we were basically defensive in nature. And then one day say to the kids, okay, tomorrow you're going out and you're going to take the offensive again. We know you've taken a pretty good pounding, but you're going out and take Hill 4 or 71 or whatever hill it was they were going to take. And these kids were able to transition immediately from a defensive posture to an offensive posture and not only do it, be able to physically do it, but to be able to do it mentally and with spirit and morale that's just unquestioned. I mean, to me, anybody, it's just a true source of amazement to me, and I have nothing but admiration for the individual troops who could do this, who could transpire themselves from an offensive to a defensive to an offensive, all in a period of 70 or 80 days, and it's just remarkable. I couldn't be prouder.
But to what do you attribute this obviously easily transitional attitude of the individual Marine?
What makes a Marine tick? You answer that, and then I'll tell you why he did it.
Let me ask the next question, Colonel, please. Reports indicated back here in the United States and throughout the world that there were some 10 or 20,000 enemy soldiers surrounding the wire, which was your outer perimeter at Quezon. Why do you suppose the North Vietnamese did not capitalize on that strength instead of attacking by piecemeal fashion?
Well, I tell you, to really get the answer, I guess you got to go get that North Vietnamese general and interview him, because I don't know what he was thinking. But if you're asking me for a personal opinion, I think you have to, that I would have to guess. And it's purely, I think we all recognize it's a guess, because we don't know what they're thinking about on the other side of the wire, really. But I would feel that the supporting arms with which we hit him, and the way in which we employed these supporting arms, and the professional manner in which these supporting arms were able to deliver the fire, disrupted all of the plans he had, and that he was forced by sheer losses of numbers to give up the plan to try a major assault on Quezon.
Colonel, during your days at Quezon, did you ever at any time experience resupply problems?
Well, I can't at the combat base itself, I never remember a day when we didn't have enough chow, water, and ammunition to keep us going. Now, there was one day, or about one day, as near as I can remember, that one of the outlying outposts experienced some difficulty in getting food. They were never short of ammunition, but one day I think we had trouble getting some rations into them, and they may have been short. It's kind of a hard, I'm trying to draw back on my memory, but I do know that within the combat base itself, not excluding the outpost, that we never were a day without chow.
Does the colonel remember, or water?
Or water, or ammunition.
Does the colonel remember why, on this particular incident, this outlying area was short of food?
We'd gotten, as I remember it, we had gotten about 7 days of bad weather when we couldn't get helicopters into that area, and this was the reason we couldn't get there. There were no roads to Hill 881, and we had to rely upon helicopter support, and we got fogged in for 7 or 8 days in a row. Matter of fact, I guess it was 11 days in a row we got fogged in. We couldn't get out there. We had adequate supplies built up, but the weather broke the day after. We were short that one day, and then the weather broke after it, and as far as I know, we were never short at any other time.
Colonel, would you elaborate on the role that the Marine artillery and also the air wing play in the defense of Khe Sanh?
Well, when you say say artillery, of course, I don't think we can go without giving due recognition to the Army units which fired out of the rock pile, the big 175s, which helped to support us. And did a truly remarkable job. The Marine artillery in Khe Sanh base itself left very little to be desired. They performed adequately. They were able to deliver close-in fires, which at times were needed. And they took a good toll, I'd say, of the enemy, and also helped to break up the attacks, particularly those attacks which were able to get in fairly close. The air, they did their usual excellent job. I guess in Marines we are such a closely integrated air ground team that the combination between ground and air gets to be almost a common thing, and you expect you don't think anything special of it, that you get real good support, and we certainly got our good close-in support from Marine Air and also from Navy Air and also from the Air Force.
Well, speaking of Air Force, what about the Air Force high-altitude radar bombing that was going on at Khe Sanh?
Well, I don't think you can discount that it was important. It was important as any other supporting arm. It had its place, and it was performed in an excellent, outstanding manner. This alone, in any part of the defense of Khe Sanh, including Marines or say Marines did this, Marines didn't do it. It was a joint coordinated effort where the Army was involved, the Air Force, the Navy, the Seabees. All the branches of the service played a part. And I certainly couldn't discount the outstanding manner in which all elements of the Air Force, not only their high-altitude radar bombing, but also their aerial port detachment did a good job. So, but this is all part of a team, and to me, the team formed admirably, and I'm proud of every member of it.
Well, then, in essence, then, am I correct in assuming that the defense of Khe Sanh and the eventual breakthrough for a land route of Highway 9 was a unified cooperation operation?
I don't think we could probably get any better example of it, and I think probably we've overlooked a very important part, because in my estimation they played an important part in it, was the 37th Arvin Battalion, Ranger Battalion. Now this unit performed real well, and they were a vital part of the defense of Khe Sanh. So it was unified not only with the United States forces, but also with the Vietnamese forces. Also, although it's not commonly known, there were PFs and CIDGs in the defense of the. So there were three elements of the South Vietnamese forces which participated in defense, and all of them did a very commendable job.
Again, going back to a strategic type of question, and perhaps the Colonel would like to answer this on a regimental commander's level. What was the thinking behind allowing such a formidable size of enemy force to congregate in a small area, a small geographically, as Khe Sanh was?
Well, I don't know how small geographically Khe Sanh was when you realize that I had the responsibility for 403 square miles. So to say that it's a small area for a regiment to try to control 403 square miles, I don't know, that's too small. You can hide quite a few troops in there. It's a difficult question to answer, as probably you were in Vietnam. The prevention of infiltration and the movement of units and the camouflage discipline of the enemy are difficult. And how do you accumulate that number? I just can't say. All I know is all of a sudden they were there.
We mentioned a minute ago about the Arvins, the PFs, the other allied forces at Khe Sanh. In what specific capacity do they serve within your command, Colonel?
Of course, the 37th Ranger Battalion had a sector of the defense which the North Vietnamese chose to try to pick on the most. As a matter of fact, they were picked on not only with mortars, artillery, and rockets and ground attacks, but they were also picked on psychologically speaking. In other words, they actually set up loudspeaker teams which tried to work on them. Considering this is their homeland and was in their native tongue, they withstood the rigors of not only the normal elements of combat, but also the rigors of a psychological campaign which was directed against them. Also, there were a small PF and force which had been around the town of Khe Sanh, which came into the combat base, and they also took up a portion of the perimeter defense. Now, so that all of the South Vietnamese forces we had were actually employed in the perimeter of the defense, which means that they were in the thick of it all the way.
You spoke a minute ago, Colonel, about psychology as applied by the enemy forces. How was the morale of your troops, 26 Marines reinforced, affected by this heavy pounding that the base obviously received? And by the same question, they're having to move underground to escape the heavy pounding. I'm talking about now the incoming.
Yeah, I don't know how our morale could have been any better. I think that it was outstanding, and as I say, I think it was a small unit leader that probably kept it that way. I think probably the feeling was one of, I know it was because I got asked the question 100 times, when do we go? Let's go. And so it was a feeling of frustration, I guess you'd say. In other words, the individual Marine and the whole wanted to get out and he wanted to go fight. And this was going to be a set-piece battle and they had to overcome it. This is another reason why I'm extremely proud that they were able to make this transition. But the morale, I could always go, no matter the time of the day or night I went, I could always go any time of the day or night and go in a trench line and get a laugh from somebody. And when you can do this, there was some griping going on. If there hadn't been, I'd have been concerned. The minute the Marine stops getting a little bit of griping, watch out, because you got problems that won't quit. But as long as he's just giving you that little bit of griping and can tell you a joke now and then, you're in business.
Colonel, what was the purpose of Operation Pegasus and also its subsequent consequence?
Gee, that's a tough question because you're asking me why General Westmoreland ordered Operation Pegasus, and I don't know why he ordered it. Its consequences were that, as you probably know, when the 1st Air Cav Division came down Route 9, and of course the 1st Marines came down Route 9, basically. They bumped into very little opposition, so to speak. I would guess that there's not much question that the reasons that I've seen, anyway, for this were that they wanted to reopen Route 9 and relieve the pressure on the Khe Sanh Combat Base.